It was going to happen at some point in this federal election campaign, and it looks like this week is the week. Let's talk about women. This probably wasn't their intention, but the Daily Telegraph's decision to go after Bill Shorten's account of his mother's career history set off a nationwide discussion about how great all our mums are and put women voters back at the centre of the campaign conversation.
Do you know that my mum wrote the book on education and law in Australia? Brilliant. She's brilliant. And that's what drives me.
We've also, over the past week, had the spectacle of Sarah Hanson-Young's defamation case against David Lionhelm, raking over what kind of comments women politicians are expected to cop. The week started with the Labor Party campaign launch, putting women front and centre.
Friends, these are the faces of the future.
They are small men. Small men with small ideas.
He's a wonderful dad. A terrible dancer. Will you please welcome my husband, Bill Shorten?
The stark contrast between Labor and the Coalition in female representation is well documented. While Labor boasts a cabinet of almost 50% women, less than a quarter of the government's cabinet are female. Voters are hungry for reforms in areas like childcare, wage increases, superannuation, aged care, issues that unambiguously affect one half of the population more than the other. What do the women of Australia want? And do they have the power to sway this election? This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. First, we're going to check in with Nick Bonahady, who is midway through an epic election odyssey from Hobart to Cairns, we're calling Bursting the Bubble. After that, I'll be joined by senior writer from the Sydney Morning Herald, Jacqueline Maley, and editor-at-large of Future Women, Jamila Rizvi.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
So Nick Bonahady, you're on the road, you're bursting the Canberra bubble. Where are you right now?
I'm in Brisbane, but shortly to depart for Townsville. So in a few hours, I hop on a train that'll take me 17 hours north. I could be in Europe at that point, but instead I'll be in Townsville.
So what are you doing? Where did you start this election odyssey and when? Tell us about the background to the project first.
So I've been on the road for exactly 2 weeks. I started when I flew down to Hobart, and I've been working my way up the country ever since. And I haven't been doing it the glamorous way. I've been on trains and buses and one ferry and one light rail. And the point of the project has just been to try and see what people outside the major capital cities are thinking this election. Are they engaged in politics? What do they care about? What's similar? What's different? And what are the stories that we're missing when we focus on the big players and the big, well-represented groups that can communicate easily?
I've travelled every road in this hill and cause I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare man, I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've travelled, I've had my chair, man.
So how engaged are people in this election?
I've had scarcely a conversation that hasn't started with some variation of I hate both the parties, a plague on both their houses, I don't follow politics very closely. That's the standard start. But you can peel back a little bit deeper. When people talk for longer, when they trust you a little bit more, they are willing to tell you about other things that matter in their lives. There's always something. The distinction, though, is that they don't always connect that to politics. So they might be really thrilled with a local bridge, or they might be very unhappy with their wages or with healthcare. But there's a real gap that exists where even though those things might be squarely within the prerogative of government, or at least able to be influenced by government, they don't see the connection between the two. So I guess the answer is they are, on a surface, highly disconnected, even if it's ultimately something that matters a great deal to them at a practical level.
Has there been any themes emerge amongst those things that people are passionate about or concerned about, even if they're not engaged in politics itself? What are the issues that have jumped out?
Aside from a general distaste to the way that politics is conducted, and I do think that is a real issue, people saying that they think that everything they see is negative, that there's a perception that politicians are only in it for themselves. Aside from that broad overall feeling at the state of politics, in terms of issues that people would like to see addressed, it's far more heterogeneous than I thought it might be. People say that they will vote on small local issues, and they also say that they'll vote on very personal things, things like their faith or their veganism. But that's not to say that the kind of things that dominate the policy discussion at a national level aren't also felt locally. People do talk about health, they do talk about their wages and economic management, but that's something that's not uniform across the country, that in different towns that I go to and different people within towns care about very different things. So I was in Grafton yesterday, and the people in Grafton who are kind of pillars of the local community, they have concerns that are very different to people who, for example, I spoke to who had just been released from the local correctional centre.
What were their concerns?
They spoke to me about a few things, but the ones that really dominated the conversation, these three blokes, were medical care in prisons. They said that they didn't receive the medications that they had been prescribed. And they also talked about poker machines. One fellow in particular, whose name was Dale, was telling me that he thinks that among the people that he's encountered, and he said he'd done 12 years in prison, in and out, across a number of states, and had obviously met a lot of people who had been down that path, that poker machines were one of the things that really contributed to the breakdown of families and ultimately to people ending up in the kind of life that he'd unfortunately been leading.
Right. Where did you meet these people?
So these guys were on the train. So as I've been heading up the North Coast, I've been taking this XPT train. It's run by the government, and it runs through a whole number of regional towns between Sydney and Brisbane. And there's another one that goes down to the south that I caught before I got to Sydney.
What's it like, the train?
Look, the scones aren't too bad, and neither are the croissants. It's a pretty standard train. If you've been on a train around Sydney or a train around Melbourne, it's not too dissimilar. The seats are slightly more comfortable and there's a food buffet. But this is not a train that, it's not the GAN, right? There's not wealthy holidaymakers on this train having a grand old time. This is very much people who are hopping from one town to another. I met a fellow named Josh. He was 20 going on 21, working in a sawmill that his dad owned. He'd moved around a bunch, wasn't enrolled to vote. He was catching the train from Maitland in the Hunter up to Gloucester, a couple of stops down the line, with a couple of mates. That's the kind of train it is. People who are just hopping up and down the country. And sure, there are some people going the long distance as well, all the way up the line. But I think a lot of people tend to fly that distance. Mm-hmm. So it is a way that you get people who are really from that area rather than just passing through.
Yeah, and probably not too many tourists, right?
No, not heaps. There's the occasional backpacker, but they tend to really stand out. One thing I've noticed is obviously I'm traveling largely during the day, so there's quite a lot of people who are retirees on those trains because they can catch them at that time. There's probably fewer people who are working families, but there as well, there'll be a bub and a mum on the train occasionally too.
And what have you noticed are the differences? I mean, you're, what, about halfway through your journey now? Not in time-wise, but in distance, because I think it speeds up a little bit towards the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Hopefully for your sake. But you know, you started in Hobart. Not only was it freezing, but what have you observed about the differences in concerns of people as you have started way down south and then come up through rural Victoria and New South Wales?
Yeah, so Tasmania has been really different from the rest. So when I was in Hobart, I took a trip out to Mona, the incredible gallery that's now not so new in that city, but has really seemed to revitalise it, boosted tourism enormously, and seems to have just changed the vibe of the place. And that's flown through to things like property prices. And that meant that the concerns there were things like house prices rising too quickly, infrastructure keeping pace with the growth, but it very much felt like a community that was growing, that was on the up. And I also spoke to some people who had moved down there looking for work because they thought it would be a better place to find it than in major metropolitan cities or in the country on the mainland. So that has felt very different to the rest of the trip. As I headed out through Wangaratta and Wagga Wagga from Melbourne, the concerns that really predominated were ones that were resolved around the drought. That was something that people cared about very deeply. And looking out from the train window, you do see a bit of greenery, but it's a green drought. Mm. So the water's not getting in deeply enough, I was told, to actually make viable crops. They'll sprout, they'll come up a little bit, so you get a misleading impression when you're just looking out the window of the train, but it's not dry enough that it'll actually boost the economic activity of those towns. And then coupled with that kind of economic depression were all the issues that come with it. So people in Wagga were telling me that the drugs are a really serious issue in that town. And then as I came from Wagga on the bus to Canberra, it's just a completely different world. Canberra has opened up a new, beautiful light rail. It was contentious, but now that it's open, people seem to love it. And it's the sort of thing that is so much nicer in Canberra than it would be in most cities. So just as a small signifier, the underside of all of the platforms is done in this really nice wood. And that's the kind of wood panelling that I'm just not sure you'd find at a suburban Sydney railway station. And the voters there had concerns that are really valid. I don't want to dismiss them as just being people who are living in the bubble. They were concerned about asylum seekers. They were concerned about the climate. Those things matter deeply. But it was a very different subset of people with different hopes and fears than the ones that you'd find in the country. And then heading up through the south coast, going through places like Bomaderry, they are industry towns. So Bomaderry had a paper mill, and that was a huge deal in that town that employed a lot of people, and the flow-on effects throughout the retailers and the barbers were huge. That closed down a couple of years ago. They've got a big ethanol and starch-producing mill, but it's still, the locals say, not quite the same as before they had that. And now coming up through Grafton, there's a bit of a sense of similar towns where just a few industries or infrastructure developments can make a big difference. And in Grafton, that's been a new bridge that's being built, and there's a new prison that's being built just outside town. That's got locals very pleased because they see that there'll be more jobs. But there's also some fears about how much the local community will get to benefit from that, and also the kind of people that it might attract to the town.
It's an amazing journey that you're on, and I'm looking forward to hearing about the other half of it. But just before you go, is there a sense from all of the conversations that you've had that either Scott Morrison or Bill Shorten have the advantage outside the bubble, or is it just that everyone is so disengaged from both parties that neither of them are really cutting through?
There's been a strange phenomenon where almost no one I've spoken to has said, I am voting for this party because of a specific policy that that party has announced. Some people have told me the opposite. They've said they won't vote for Labor, for example, because they're a small business owner and they know that the penalty rates are going to hit them. I've been told that, and I've been told that people won't vote for the coalition because of their lack of action on climate change. But almost no one has said that they are going to vote for a party because of a specific policy. And so when they've talked about the wanting to vote for one of those major parties, it's largely been on a conviction about the vibe of that party and what they care about. I'd say in numbers, more people have probably said that they would vote for Scott Morrison, but that's often complicated by some affection for one of the minor parties, whether that's One Nation or Clive Palmer, and that's muddied the waters, whereas Labor voters tend to tell me that they'll vote for Labor and they're not really considering one of the smaller parties. So outside the bubble, is there a strong feeling for one or either party? I wouldn't say so. And when people do say they'll vote for one of those major parties rather than going to one of the smaller players, it's often not on the basis that they are just thrilled with what the Liberals are doing or the Nationals are doing. It's that they think that the minor parties might be ineffective in getting their agenda up, given they won't have as many seats in Parliament. So it's been a practical choice rather than one motivated out of affection or love for the Prime Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister or the Opposition Leader.
Well, Nick, I know that you find this very hard to believe, but a lot of your older desk-bound colleagues are very jealous of the journey that you're on. And it is fascinating. The blog, it's like a slow-burning blog that you're writing, and it's really interesting. It's getting updated every day. And listeners, if you would like to read about Nick's adventures and the conversations that he's having, if you go to the Herald or the Age website and have a look at our federal politics strap, you'll find a hilarious gif of Nick, and you'll be able to doing a small dance, and you'll be able to read about his adventures there. Mate, thanks so much for your time.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks, Tori.
Hi, I'm Jess Irvine. Thanks for listening to Please Explain. The Sydney Morning Herald and Age newsrooms are home to the country's most experienced economics editors and reporters, delivering trusted news and analysis. But we can't do it without you. Our subscribers get unlimited access to our award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe today and support news you can trust.
Jamila Rizvi is the editor-at-large of Future Women and a former Labor staffer. Jacqueline Maley is a senior journalist and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Tori.
Thanks for having me.
Jamila, this is your first time on Please Explain. Welcome.
Oh, there's so many jokes to make off that little sentence, but I'm going to try not to make them.
Can you just tell us what you're up to now and what you used to do for a living?
So I am the editor-at-large for Future Women, which is a subscription-led women's club, but a whole lot of content and events that go along with that as well. But we take a kind of women's lens on the news and issues affecting Australia. And in a previous life, before the media and before a family, I was a political staffer. I worked in the Rudd government and the Gillard government.
Right. So we'll take everything you say about the Labor Party today with a grain of salt.
I'm one of those people who thinks I'm remarkably unbiased and anyone else thinks I am not that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's good to get that out in the open. Let's start. I want to talk about Bill Shorten's mum.
My mum came from a working class family. She was the first in her family in the early 50s to ever go to university, ever. If my mum, she became a teacher, but she wanted to be a lawyer, but she was the eldest in the family, so needed to take the teacher scholarship to look after the rest of the kids.
He gave a press conference on Wednesday morning after a story appeared on the front page of the Daily Telegraph questioning his account of his mother's career and career setbacks that he gave during Q&A on Monday night.
I'm glad she wasn't here today to read that rubbish. Just rubbish. She'd wanted to do law when she was 17. She didn't get that chance. She raised kids. At 50, she backed herself. At 53, going to the bar, she got a barrister and she read from, that's the technical term, that was the apprenticeship. She did her best. She went down and did some magistrate's court work. But she discovered in her mid-50s that sometimes you're just too old. And you shouldn't be too old, but she discovered the discrimination against older women. And so she eventually, while she kept her name on the bar roll for a number of years, she came back and she did other things. Do you know that my mum wrote the book on education and law in Australia? Brilliant. She's brilliant.
It's very hard for us to talk about our mums without getting emotional. Do you think this was a campaign moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, although it might have been upsetting for Bill Shorten, I think in a way it's actually been a gift to him. The main criticism that we hear about Shorten is that people don't quite like him. They don't really know what he's about. They're not quite sure that he's a genuine guy. This has given him actually a platform to talk about what he believes in. To talk about what motivates him into politics, and it has humanised him in a way that nothing else he's been able to do or say on sort of highfalutin policy matters has been able to. So in a backhanded kind of possibly painful kind of a way, I actually think it's been a boost for his campaign, and it's given him an opportunity, yeah, to talk about the stuff that really matters, and it's given him a bit of heart. Which I think perhaps he was lacking in people's eyes previously.
Jamila, it certainly hasn't done Scott Morrison any favours, has it, at this point in the campaign when he's fighting a perception that he has, not personally a problem with women, but the Liberal Party has a problem with women. It's a bit of a disaster for him, isn't it? Not of his own making.
I think it is. I think it definitely is a big plus in the Shorten column. And you can see how aware of that Morrison is in that he's out today criticising the media for touching this issue as well and saying our families shouldn't be relevant and don't need to be brought into this. I mean, and that is him positioning. At the moment, he's looking for any dirt he possibly can find on Shorten. And yet he's saying, oh, no, this isn't us. This was the media. This wasn't my side. I do think it was a really humanising moment for Bill. As we just said, I used to work in politics, and one of the hard parts is when you're a member of parliament or a minister or a prime minister or opposition leader is when your family get brought into stuff, and it is a moment that prompts genuine emotion. And I think in Australian politics, we're pretty good for the most part of leaving that stuff to the side, but when it gets dragged in, I think it gets messy straight away.
I think the thing that was really interesting is that this would not have been the intention of having the story on the front page of the Daily Telegraph,
no.
But it really kicked off a national conversation about how great mums are.
Yeah, and it, you know, in the lead up to Mother's Day, and it also, you know, the way that Shorten framed the original story and also the sort of his response to the backlash about the Telegraph story is sort of a story about women's potential, which is so on the zeitgeist. You know, it's about women who want to go to work, and it's about women who want to use their brains and have satisfying and fulfilling lives and careers as well as manage family. That is the talking point, you know, or one of the main talking points for the campaign. And this is right on point because it's about his mum who is, you know, by his telling, a brilliant woman, and, you know, she eventually did win, you know, a prize when she went to law school. But she only ever got 9 briefs as a barrister because she just, you know, it's a tragic story. And it's a story of so many people, so many women of that generation. So it's actually kind of, I don't know, it's illuminating. Something larger, a larger theme which very much plays into sort of Labor values, I guess.
I think it's a very common story for that generation. I mean, I know many, many women of my mum's age and her friends and her situation, which sounds like a very similar story to Mrs. Shorten's story. But the thing I think that it also does, Jamila, is that it reminds people that there are structural issues for women even now. I mean, all three of us, it's hard for any of us to complain. We're all mothers and we all have great careers. So we are not hard done by. But there is certainly a structural, especially in politics, hurdle for women to overcome to have success, isn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And I think now that some of those more obvious barriers to gender equality have disappeared within the economy, it's easy to get complacent and to start to say, you know, it's not as bad as it used to be, so don't stress so much. We're on this inevitable march towards equality. We'll get there soon enough. You know, I think if politics over the last few years has taught us anything, both across the world and here at home, it's that's not true. It isn't an inevitable march towards equality, that we can go backwards, and that there are some really deep-seated cultural and structural issues within the way our society and economies work that mean that women still aren't on a level playing field with blokes in a whole lot of ways.
So let's talk about women in politics on the, you know, incredibly small dance floor that is being, you know, in federal parliament. Over the last week, we've watched Sarah Hanson-Young in court in her case against David Lionhelm. It's a defamation case after he said to her, "Why don't you stop shagging men?" In relation to her position on, you know, women's issues. That case has been hard to watch. There's been lots of senators give evidence. It really has sort of brought out into the open what female politicians, like, where is the line? There is the line that there's the Twitter line, which is, you know, anonymous trolls threatening horrendous sexual violence on women that, you know, we're expected to just, you know, block and report and shut down. But this is actually about what it's okay for one politician to say to another politician in the Senate chamber. Where is the line? What do women have to put up with?
I mean, I would say they should not have to put up with that. You know, I guess what we're seeing culturally at the moment, and particularly in our politics, is a bit of an unearthing, or a, you know, the kind of the rocks being pulled up, and we're shining a light underneath, and we're seeing that women, to just do their job in a way that looks pretty similar on the surface to their male equivalent, have to be, you know, working a lot subterraneously under the radar. They have to be, you know, the little duck legs are paddling all the time to overcome these obstacles that their male counterparts just don't have to overcome or don't face in the first place. And one of those things, obviously, as a female politician, is just abuse from your colleagues, like misogynistic, sexist abuse from your colleagues that happens across the chamber and literally cannot be heard or picked up on the microphones. So it's like, it's so invisible to the public, and it's so invisible to, you know, the voters, and yet the toll that it must take, you know, would be pretty big, I imagine.
Jamila, you worked for a female minister, Kate Ellis. She managed to combine for a period motherhood and being a minister. She's made the decision now that she would like to prioritise being at least at home in the same city as her children. What did you observe when you were working for her about the differences between what male politicians deal with and female politicians deal with?
Yeah, so I worked for Kate before she had children, but she was, you know, quite the anomaly in Canberra at the time. She was a young woman in a very powerful position, and Kate is a really beautiful woman as well, and that definitely fed into it. People just didn't feel like she fitted the mould of what they expected from a politician. And there was definitely a lot that came across the chamber at her. I remember that the opposition at the time used to chant, "Here comes the weather girl," in a way.
The weather girl?
When she used to come up to the dispatch box to speak. But it was always in a way that didn't get caught. I know, right? Yeah. Didn't get caught by the microphones, didn't get caught by the cameras. And this isn't a one side of politics issue, and it isn't just a minor parties issue. Across the board, there is a problem in that building with respect for women in the chamber and the nature of the abuse being different. And, you know, I think it's quite similar to the social media world in that men and women both cop a whole lot of abuse, but the men on Twitter tend to be abused for their opinions and the women tend to be abused because if they had an opinion in the first place, but the abuse itself becomes sexual or becomes violent or becomes really gendered very quickly. Mm. I think Kate's circumstance is similar to a lot of younger women in Parliament or women who are having children. That parliamentary life, particularly federal parliamentary life, is not particularly compatible with parenthood.
Mm.
And I think you see that borne out most clearly in the very, very few number of working mums who become ministers from WA, because there's no question that it's toughest when you're travelling, you know, what most people in the world consider an international flight to get to Parliament for 20-odd weeks a year. It's pretty rough. And most of the high-profile women we've seen come out of Western Australia, most of the women who've become ministers or senior in governments don't have kids.
So the ALP have brought in quotas, representative quotas, and are now going to this election with, I think, 50% of their front bench being women, which is a huge selling point for them amongst women voters and possibly amongst some male voters too. Is it still hard to get women to actually want to go into politics because of these issues?
I think on the abuse stuff, I think, you know, Julia Gillard sort of faced this, and I think history will be a lot kinder to her than the reporting was at the time. Because when you're abused in that way, you have to take the abuse and then you have to make a decision about whether or not you're going to talk about the abuse or call it out in any way publicly. And if you do call it out publicly, you get accused of playing the victim or playing the woman card, as Julia Gillard was when, you know, after she made her famous misogyny speech. But neither sort of route and shutting up about it and just sort of subsuming the experience doesn't work either. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I just can't imagine, and all of the young people I talk to and all of the sort of research that about young women in particular in politics says, no way. Like, why would you go into that career? Why would you sign up for that? There's nothing about it that's appealing or attractive. And it would just be, even if you went in with all the best intentions and wanted to do a really good job, but it'd just be very hard to do a good job to rise above that stuff, I think.
Would you recommend it, Jamila, to anyone that you love?
That's a difficult question to answer. I've got a few friends who are contesting this election who are young mums. And to be honest, chatting to them, you know, they're looking ahead and saying, okay, if I'm successful and I end up in federal parliament and I've got young children, what's my life going to look like? And I think it is a big risk and it's a huge factor for most families. And I think increasingly men are feeling that pressure as well. But we see it borne out for women far more so and far more regularly. And I do think there's a huge number of young women who look to that arena as a career and go, you've got to be kidding me. Like, what about that is appealing? What about that would make me want to get into it? And I think it was Anne Summers gave a great presentation at Newcastle Uni, I think it was about a year and a half after Gillard lost the leadership, saying if she had been in any other profession, what was said about her in the parliament and what was done to her by the media and in the public from a gender perspective would have been a breach of the Fair Work Act. Like, she was treated appallingly.
So let's talk about policy. Let's take all the sort of gendered stuff away and look at the policy. Do either side, have they prioritised things that are going to appeal to women voters?
Look, I think there's a pretty stark distinction in this election on that point. And it's hard to talk about it without sounding partisan, but I wrote a column about this a couple of weeks ago. I had a look at the Liberal Party website, and they have a sort of tab where you can look at their women policies. And the first thing that they have is, you know, that they've it's sort of a boast about economic management. And because the economy's going well, more women are in employment. It seems like a pretty low bar. And that's their premier sort of women's policy. On the other hand, you had, the Labor Party gave a sort of particular women's policy launch a few weeks ago with, you know, a childcare policy, which you might think is a good or a bad or a mediocre policy, but it is a policy that's pitched at working women who find that juggle incredibly difficult and financially taxing.
It's an irritating fact of life, though, isn't it, that a childcare policy is a policy for women?
And that's why, yes, it is. But I take that point, but I also think you've got to be realistic about it, because it is women who take the hit on that in most households, and it's women who do the large part of that juggle. I made the point in my column a few weeks ago that just because the Labor Party has a policy or two that that connect with women or that are pitched at women doesn't mean that they should necessarily get a lot of credit for it. But it shows you how low our bar is, because in my opinion, the election campaign so far has been incredibly blokey, and certainly on the Liberal side, because they don't have a great story to tell on women, I think they're avoiding the issue pretty pointedly.
Mm. Jamila, how much do you think women who are not particularly engaged in politics but have to make a decision come May 18, how much does this weigh into their decision making? I mean, I sort of feel uncomfortable with the idea that women just vote on women's issues. I don't think that's true, but do you think that this election particularly women are looking at the composition of the front bench and the policies about women and wondering how that will affect them?
I think there's two parts to that. The first is the people that you're voting for, and most of the data shows that women don't necessarily just vote for women across the world, but if they're faced with a group of candidates that they consider the same, roughly, being a woman will make them more likely to vote for that woman. So in the Hare Clark system, for example, or in the Senate, where you're voting for a group, women are more likely to pick out the women names on that ballot paper and vote for them if they consider all those offerings are the same otherwise. But on the policy front, I feel like the divide that we're seeing, and I agree that the two parties are miles apart when it comes to an offering for women, but I think the divide that we're more likely to see between voters is going to come down to age demographics and location across the country, more than it is going to come down to gender. That's my expectation from this election. And I think, you know, at the start of this discussion, we were talking about that Daily Telegraph piece. I think it's really telling that it didn't run in Victoria. I'm Victorian based. No one down here is talking about it. It wasn't on the front pages of our papers. And I think that is a reflection of how differently different states are approaching this election. The mood is different in Queensland to down here in Victoria. It's different in New South Wales to in WA. And I think we're going to see that split and the generational divide play out more than we're going to see the gender divide play out, despite the quite stark difference in the offerings of the parties on policy and also in terms of just the women that are up for election. The Labor Party isn't just offering a gender-neutral potential cabinet. I think they've said that most likely on a seat-by-seat outcome, if Labor do win in line with what most polls are telling us, that women will for the first time make up more than 50% of the parliamentary representatives. And that's a pretty big thing.
Can we just talk about the wives for a minute?
Mm.
Because I think maybe both sides are very conscious of the look that, you know, you turn on a debate now and it's two men in suits and they're pretty much interchangeable. The suits are practically identical. They just, one wears a red tie and one wears a blue tie. Both of them have put their wives at front and centre of the campaign. Obviously, some kind of research or advice is telling them that this is a good idea. I don't get it. Talk me through this. I don't understand why people think that the politicians' wives are going to help. Do they help?
I think absolutely they do. And I don't think there's much science to it. I think that if you get a really nice woman who's intelligent and articulate and, you know, they're both good-looking women,
They both seem very warm.
They both seem warm. They're motherly. All of those things.
They both make very overt displays of their adoration of their husbands.
Yeah. So you get that woman and to stand up and talk about why she loves her husband and why her husband is a good man. And people think, well, she's really nice. She looks nice. She doesn't seem overly partisan and she likes him. So there must be something good about him. I just think it's as simple as that.
Right. Do you think it works, Jamila?
I think it does. I agree. I think it's a humanising question. And you've got two blokes leading parties, neither of whom are hugely popular as individuals with the electorate. And I think their partners are seen as an asset to the campaign. And I think it is as simple as talking to the electorate and saying, hey, she likes him. And she seems smart and switched on and sensible. He can't be that bad. And I think they're trying to humanise in different ways. You know, Bill Shorten's had this perception over time around being the union guy, being a guy involved in the change of prime ministers, that backroom dealing kind of view. So you want to humanise him and you want to warm him up from a political perspective and you want to show he's a family man and he's got this, you know, lovely, glamorous, clever, capable wife who adores him. And from Morrison's side of the coin, it's a slightly different challenge in that you've got a guy that I think the electorate doesn't know very well, you know, and what they do know of him is pretty tough. They remember him as immigration minister more than anything, being tough on borders and saying things that weren't exactly warm and fuzzy. And his challenge has been to humanise in a different way. And I think, again, wife and kids does do that to an extent.
All right, well, we will find out in a little bit over a week.
If the wife factor helped.
Thanks so much to both of you for being on. And Jamila, thanks for coming on for the first time.
Appreciate it.
Jamila Rizvi is the editor-at-large at Future Women and a former Labor staffer. Jacqueline Maley is a senior journalist and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald. Thanks to our guests this week, the ever-intrepid Nick Bonahady out on the road, plus our panellists Jamila Rizvi and Jack Maley. Let us know how you're finding Please Explain during the election campaign and what else you'd like to hear. Our email address is in the show notes for this episode. And as always, a review and a rating on your podcast app goes a long way. Or even better, tell a friend who should be listening. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Get full access to all of our election coverage and special events by becoming a subscriber today. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Thanks to the team behind this week's episode. Production and editing from Rachel Dexter and David Escort. Audio assistance from Debbie Harrington. Amelia Maguire does our logistics and planning. David McMillan and Yuji Shimada take care of all of our recordings and tech. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.